The show's Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and it's your connection to local music and often much more. Today we have a couple of groups which are quite varied, I think. The first is three members of a new group called Vox Shambana, as in Champagne Urbana, Vox as in voice, and they are specializing in music of the Renaissance, of which we will hear a very brief sample or two in the first portion of the show. They're giving a concert Thursday night at the Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign. And then on the later portion of the show, we have a number of players of the viola, all members of the studio of Masumi Rostad at the University of Illinois. They have a studio recital coming up tomorrow night. And so they brought along a few of their members to try out some Bach on us and see how they do. And I'm sure they'll do fine and we'll enjoy some good music. It's Live and Local today on FM 90.9. Stay with us. That was music by Henry Purcell called Sweeter Than Roses, sung by soprano Emma Kirkby and featuring lutenist Anthony Rulli here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I haven't heard any of Purcell's music in a very long time, and nor have I heard Emma Kirkby in a very long time, and I enjoyed that, hope you did. And we've got some vocal music in the first part of the show today, although it will not be from that particular time period. The group called Vox Shambana, assuming that's how you all say the name, is on a mission of sorts dedicated to promoting the music of the Renaissance, which comes just before the time of Purcell. And they are going to be giving their first concert this Thursday evening at 7:30 at the Episcopal Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign. It's barely in Champaign. It's on Wright Street on the Champaign side of Wright Street. And there are, I'm not sure how many members, we'll find out in a moment, but the members who are here with us are John K. Cox, who is a doctoral student in choral conducting at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, and Matthew Lease, who is also a doctoral student, I believe.
Correct.
Also in choral conducting.
Also in choral conducting.
All right. And John Wagstaff, who is not a doctoral student by any stretch of the imagination. He is, in fact, a head librarian at the School of Music Library at the University of Illinois. So welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
To Live and Local. Whose idea was this?
Well, I have to take the responsibility for that. I've been interested in this period of music ever since I was an undergraduate in music history studies, just learning about what some people refer to as the golden age of vocal music, the 16th century. And the polyphony composed during that time period, specifically the music that was going above and beyond the typical choral textures. When most people think of choral music these days, they think of an SATB, four-part
soprano,
texture.
Soprano, alto, tenor, bass.
Correct. And because most of the upper lines, well, all of the upper lines in church music during this period were sung by male falsettists or boy trebles, the SATB instrument, per se, didn't exist at this time period. So what you have is in the beginning of the 16th century, we have a three-part texture, which is normal. Over the course of the 16th century, that norm grows to a five- and six-part texture, often divided at the soprano. So you would have two sopranos, essentially alto, tenor, bass, or the other variant of that, one soprano, alto, tenor, tenor, bass. But around the middle of the 16th century, composers start going beyond that into 7, 8, 9, and larger pieces, larger textures of music. And that's always fascinated me. And so when I arrived in Champaign, I started seeing that there were a lot of quality singers in the town, people interested in early music, and I might just have the right ingredients to get a group together to be able to do these larger scale textures for choral music.
And how long ago did you arrive in Champaign?
This is my first year here, so in August I moved to town.
So you wasted very little time in trying to do this.
I was excited to get a group together to try out this repertoire.
Yeah, there's a lot of singers, and there's a number of singers who are interested in early music. Early meaning, let's say, Baroque and earlier, mm-hmm. in what I mean by that. Early music often means exactly your period and earlier. You really want to talk earlier, Renaissance and medieval music. And, of course, you guys, the other two who are here, are some of the more active vocalists in the area. John, you've been singing with the Baroque artists of Champaign-Urbana.
That's right.
And I don't know who else.
Anybody will have me.
Well, that's limiting, isn't it?
It is fairly limiting, yeah. Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, well, John and I know each other for a little bit. But you all don't know that until I told you, so we'll try to be nice to each other. And Matt Lees, actually, I think we're going to be hearing from another group that you're involved in.
You are. I'm really excited about that, too.
Yeah, a week from today. And,
exactly.
And you do even earlier music.
Yes, we do a lot of music ranging from Hildegard von Bingen, and sometimes even earlier, so the 10th and 11th century, right through to the 17th century with our group Gravitation.
That's so long ago, you almost wonder if they even wrote music then.
Sometimes it's really hard to decipher, yeah.
And which we'll certainly talk about then. John, since you decided to get this going, have you felt that there isn't really much going on in the Renaissance performance around here?
Well, there's certainly a lot of interest at the university. The Renaissance is a part of the whole package in terms of the education of the choral conductors, and so I wouldn't say that there's a lack of Renaissance music, but I wanted to get a group together to have something. A steady group to get together and try out these pieces, almost like a laboratory. And once we met, we really decided that some very nice sounds were coming out, and we'd like to move towards a performance ensemble.
Sure. Well, yeah, if you're going to prepare this stuff, you might as well go out and sing it for people. How many people in the group?
There's eight of us.
Mm-hmm. And does that represent all four parts, and do you vary on whether it's double sopranos or double tenors?
Yes, essentially we have two sopranos, two altos, two tenors, and two basses, although some of that switches around a little bit depending on the needs of the piece. For example, both Matt and I will occasionally sing alto as falsettists. So,
for those who may not know that term, falsettist, talk about that a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you've ever heard the Beach Boys or the Bee Gees, then you've heard the male falsetto at its best.
That's a good point.
it's something that in the English choral tradition is quite common, although in the U.S. you don't hear boy trebles or adolescent falsettists or even male falsettists that often in classical or art music. It's something that in pop music is accepted, but not as well known in the classical music realm. So it's essentially using the falsetto voice, and what happens when you do that is that the vocal cord, the muscle, pinches one half of that, not pinch, but only one half of your cord is vibrating. It's the same concept as on a guitar. If you put your finger in the middle of the fret, you get a much higher sound than the whole length of the string, and so it's using the...
Just touching the fret.
Correct, yeah. Correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
Without actually pressing on it.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like it. Well, not really like getting harmonics, I guess, on a string instrument. That would be a whole other thing
right.
with the overtone series.
Mm-hmm.
You brought some music along to sing, of course,
mm-hmm.
Two pieces. What are we going to start with?
We'd like to start with a plain chant that was one of the most popular pieces of plain chant in England in the late medieval period and the Renaissance. It is Alma Redemptoris Mater, which is a prayer to the Virgin Mary. So this plain chant is particularly remarkable because it starts out with this spanning the octave right away. And the octave was a larger interval than most plain chant ever got around to spanning. So it's quite a lovely plain chant.
That essentially means from the bottom of a standard scale to the top of a standard scale. Yeah, da 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 da. There's your octave.
Right.
That span of time.
Mm-hmm.
Just want to make sure that everybody listening knows what we're talking
okay.
about. Okay. Okay, so this is not polyphonic, and I'm going to ask you about polyphony later on, but if I remember, this is just one line of music sung unison by these three voices of Vox Shambana, who are giving a concert Thursday night at the Chapel of St. John the Divine in Champaign, 7:30, and they're here with us live in Studio F on Live and Local.
Redemptoris Mater, quae per via Caeli porta manes, et stella manis succure cadensi, suggere qui curat populo, tuque genuisti natura mirante. Tum sanctum genitorem Virgo Primus ac posteri Gabrielis abore, sum exiludave, peccatorum misere.
Wonderful exploitation of the cathedral acoustics here at in our studio at Live and Local here on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. And those are three members of Vox Shambana, a brand new group in Champaign-Urbana community. They refer to themselves as handpicked, picked presumably by John Cox, who is the director here. Well, do you consider yourself the director or just the guy who got everything together?
Maybe the organizer, but it's really a collaborative effort.
Good. Glad to hear it. And the other members are John Wagstaff and Matt Lees, who are with us right now, Matthew Lees, who is, you're New Zealand?
I am from New Zealand,
good.
Proudly.
Oh, glad I didn't step in it and say Australia.
Most people do.
Yeah, well, I was just kind of going on memory. What brought you to the University of Illinois?
It happened in a roundabout way. I first came over to study in Boston and did a performance diploma in medieval music there at the Longy School of Music, and then decided to carry on studies for various personal reasons and ended up at Indiana University where I did my master's. And since then I've been working at Millikan, and it just made a lot of sense to get a terminal degree, and I've always wanted to focus in choral conducting, so this is obviously one of the best places in the country to do that, and I was really happy to get started here.
Good. Well, we're glad you're active in forming other groups and getting different kinds of music sung that haven't been sung very public. I mean, the thing about the university setting is that there's an enormous number of performances that happen here that nobody is aware of, put on by students, and I'm just going to make this pitch for those that very large number of really fine concerts being given by undergraduate, graduate students, faculty members, and really recommend that folks who live anywhere near the community every once in a while check out the University of Illinois School of Music website. They've got an events calendar on there, and most of these things are free or very inexpensive, and it's a great way to hear a very large and varied amount of music performed very well for almost nothing, and sometimes, and as I said, most often, absolutely nothing. I said I wanted to ask about polyphony, which is a very large topic since you used the term right up front as referring to Renaissance polyphony. But for those who don't know what that means at all, what does it mean? And what's significant about the Renaissance polyphony?
Well, I can best explain the concept by comparing it to the opposite type of choral texture, which would be homophony. So anyone who's ever sung a hymn, which is in a church or where you might find him singing, the rhythm and the text move in unison with all the parts. And that's a homophonic, meaning one sound, texture. Polyphony, or many sounds, is when each part is independent of the other part in terms of their line, their text. It's almost like each part is doing their own thing in relation to the others.
Right. So often, and you were talking about the number of pieces that have many voices, everybody's going to have their own line, or often have their own line. They might join up with others every once in a while and then go about their way. What are some of the challenges presented by this kind of music to the singer? Anybody?
Keeping your own line, I would guess, when everybody else has got varied music around you. I mean, a lot of polyphony is what is called imitative, which means one voice will start and the other voices will come in using the same basic melodic shape at the beginning of the line, and then will go their own way to make particular harmonies. Of course, this is one wonderful thing about polyphony, that while you have the different voices going along in their own register, they are making vertical consonances with each other, they're making harmonies with each other, and that's and the skill in making those consonances is the beauty of polyphonic composition. That's where you see the real skill of the composer, in the way that those polyphonic voices are put together.
And there were, I guess back then, mostly unwritten rules about how to do this, and people have since written the rules down based on what people like Palestrina and others actually did. But they were making it up as they went along. But at the same time, there were certain ways you should do it and shouldn't do it. And it was either good or it wasn't.
Well, theory follows practice as usual. So what would happen would be that particular composers would have learnt from a master, from a composer from a previous generation, or maybe from their own generation. And so musical practice has always been passed down a little bit like that, and then gets codified by theorists rather than composers. There aren't many composers who write books on music theory. Yeah. They're too busy composing. It's the theorists who come along later. And we know quite a lot about the theory of medieval and Renaissance music from these theorists. I mean, those theoretical writings help us to understand how composition was done in earlier centuries. But I would imagine, and certainly with a lot of the music that we're performing in the concert on Thursday, a lot of those composers were at the English Chapel Royal. They would have learnt from each other, and therefore there was a whole tradition of craftsmanship in composition.
So is the suggestion then that much of the music on this concert is English?
Yes. Apart from two of the plain chants, it's all English.
All English.
English music.
Mm-hmm. And that's hardly limiting, because there's such a wonderful breadth and variety of English earlier music. I guess this can be a challenge for some singers, but certainly a difference in approach for Renaissance music, depending upon what group you're singing in, is whether or not to use vibrato, for example, or just how to use the voice. What are the reasons for those choices?
Yeah, that's a really thorny issue. And unlike,
that's why I brought it up.
I know it.
We have all of
the
minute
devil's
to address
advocate.
It.
going on from what John was talking about, we know so much about the compositional kind of practice of the 15th and 16th century, but we really know very, very little about the actual sound of the choirs or even of voices. And there are a handful of comments from certain travelers or from some theorists who talk about, well, at this chapel they did it this way, where the voices sounded high and light. So we get these kind of very, very overall roundabout suggestions of how we might want to sound. And a lot of performing groups in the last half century, since the kind of rebirth of early music performance practice, have based a lot of their decisions on acoustics. So if you go to a very, very washy cathedral, like most of them are from that period, that you have to be a very, very sensitive singer, and very, very sensitive to the other parts, but also sensitive to your overall loudness. So it goes hand in hand with vibrato, because the louder you sing, the more vibrato comes into the voice. And vice versa, the softer you sing, generally the less vibrato there is.
But of course, either way, you can choose to use it or not, to at least to a certain point. And then the other side of the coin, from some vocal instructors, for example, as well. The voice produces vibrato naturally, and so therefore to be faithful to your voice and use it in the most healthy way, you should always use vibrato.
Exactly, and this has been an argument for 100 years, but in my opinion, it is possible to sing without vibrato or with minimal vibrato and keep a healthy instrument. And there, it's actually really great now that there is a generation of aging early music performers who have, I hate to say that word, but they really are.
The Not end, you, John.
Okay,
the mid to end of their careers who have sung healthily, much more healthily than a lot of opera singers have. For example, Emma Kirkby, as you just played,
sure.
who has had a marvelously long and healthy career, and to my knowledge, doesn't cancel concerts. Or, it happens.
Yeah,
so
of course.
I think that there is an argument for being able to do it healthily.
Well, and the great argument from a listener's point of view, I mean, I'm also somebody who has sung this music too, but not for a very long time, is that you frankly sing it better in tune when you get rid of the vibrato, you know, mm-hmm, and so
exactly.
That's huge.
I think there's also an element as well with this type of music that we're singing, that music in church was designed to help contemplation. And arguably, you could say if somebody had a very distinctive vibrato voice, they were in some way privileging their voice over the other singers, and that would probably not have been seen as very good from a liturgical or theological point of view, where it's a matter of the singers effectively, as I say, producing this soundscape, if you like, against which hopefully people in the church were praying or simply hopefully thinking divine thoughts and so on. So the use of vibrato maybe, I would imagine, it could have caused a problem with those sort of congregations, and it certainly seems that people naturally fall into performing this type of music from the 15th and 16th centuries without vibrato. It seems to work well without vibrato.
Well, so wow, I really stepped in here with it's a political issue, it's a theological issue, and all the things you're never supposed to talk about in company. Well, we have coming up some music by Bach for, I was going to say several violists, but there's actually several violists each going to play some music by Bach in just a few minutes. And that gives us time to hear your other piece, which is?
This is To Angelus Dominus by Hugh Aston, who's a lesser-known English composer from the first half of the 16th century. And this is a fragment of text from the Marian version of the Te Deum text, which has completely fallen out of usage. But in the Middle Ages and Renaissance, they had both the Te Deum, which we know is set by many composers, that text, a prayer to the Lord, and this version, which is the pair, I assume, which is Tu Matrem, you mother.
And so I'm guessing there's some polyphony in this one.
There is. This is for three. This is a three-part composition, and you'll hear, as John described, the imitation involved in the polyphony.
Well, that's good, since we have three singers here. It's very convenient. John K. Cox and John Wagstaff and Matthew Lees, members of Vox Shambana, here on Live and Local.
Thank you.
Three members of Vox Shambana, John Cox, John Wagstaff, and Matthew Leese, performing music by Hugh Aston, was it? Of the period of Renaissance England. They're going to be performing that and other music on Thursday night at 7:30 at the Chapel of St. John the Divine on Wright Street in Champaign. And it's their inaugural concert, brand new group. There's 8 singers total, just 3, of course, on the show today. And I hope when you have your next concert, give me some notice, and let's see if we can work out having everybody in here, which would be a real treat.
Great.
Thank you all very much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And good luck with the first concert. It's Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. WILO's programs in FM 90.9 are made by Women's Health Practice and Dr. Suzanne Troopin, offering obstetrics, gynecology, and fertility services on Neal and Champaign. Women's Health Practice is a Health Alliance medical plan provider and is accepting new patients. More information is available at womenshealthpractice.com. This is Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. This portion of the show, we have four violists with us, as in players of the viola, all of them members of the studio of Masumi Rostad at the University of Illinois School of Music. Masumi is one of the members of Pacifica Quartet, and logically enough, he's the violist there. And they're doing an interesting concert tomorrow night of, tomorrow evening, of all Bach's music. And the four who are with us are Jan Matthews, Luis Bellerin, Alyssa Rago, and Jing Chen. And understand, Jan, this was kind of your project, or at least you're organizing the project?
Yeah, I volunteered to get things running with the whole project. Masumi's idea was that we try and do at least one performance project each year. And naturally, the biggest set of works that violas play are the six suites originally written for unaccompanied cello. But it's something that all violas play almost all the time. So that was a good place to start. And we picked a date, and we decided to the easiest way to divide up the movements was just simply to, I think we went alphabetically down the list. And then we did some trade-offs and things like that, and we came up with the program as it is tomorrow night. So we won't be playing all six suites. We only go up to number five. The sixth suite is a little contentious. There's even some debate whether the cello suites were even written for the cello. And the sixth suite is written for a cello with, I forget, it's either a string that's tuned differently, or even a five-string cello, maybe. So that specific suite doesn't translate well to the viola, so we stuck to the first five.
So is it violists who wonder whether these were really written for the cello?
No, I just went on Wikipedia the other day. And
well, then, the ultimate authority.
Then we would know. Whenever you ask a cellist about this kind of thing, they wouldn't hear much of it.
Oh, of course not.
Yeah, so maybe it is up to a violist to make this discovery in the end.
Well, that's fine. You can do that, and they can tell their jokes about and against you all, and so on. You know, you asked me ahead of time if there was any particular questions, and I forgot that I should have asked you each to bring in a viola joke. But I'll bet you all know plenty.
Yeah. Should we go down the line?
I actually don't have one.
You don't? Okay.
Except I was in a quartet coaching the other day, and I got called out for not counting right. And
the accusations frequently hurled at violists, right?
I knew it was coming. I knew it was coming at some point.
Okay, who's got one?
What's the definition of perfect pitch? Is being able to throw a viola in the toilet without hitting the sides.
Jing, you have one?
Well, Kevin, what's the difference between the first chair and the last chair of a viola section?
I'm not really sure.
About half a measure.
Okay. And that, for those who don't know, that means that the suggestion is that violas tend to be behind, okay?
I don't have any.
You don't know?
Oh, no.
I'm actually trying to remember a conductor joke, and I can't think of any of those either. Those are particularly mean.
Yes.
Those are really cruel.
Well, I do have a combo conductor viola joke.
Oh, there you go, sure.
Yeah. So one time the conductor of the orchestra got sick. There was an emergency, had to leave. And so the orchestra manager went up and was like, can anyone fill in for the conductor? We really need somebody. And so then nobody raised their hand. So finally the last chair violists raised his hand, and he went up and was a great conductor. Everybody loved him. And he was there for about a week and just leading the orchestra. And then finally he went back. When the conductor came back, he sat back down, and his stand partner looked at him and said, where have you been all week?
The thing about these jokes is they're rather inside jokes, so would require a lot of explanation, and that one probably as well. But I enjoyed it. Thank you very much. I don't know if violists would. Well, anyway, you came to play some Bach.
Yes, we did.
I just had to get that out of my system. So are we doing sequential in one suite, or do you all have movements from different suites?
Well, because of how it ended up, we all pretty much have movements from different suites. I think we have the first three covered, or
I'm playing two.
One from the first, one from the second, and then two from the first. So I was going to go first. I'm playing the two Barret movements from the fourth suite, which is an E flat major.
Is that the original key, or that's the key for violists?
Oh, well, because viola is only two octaves higher than a cello, you play it exactly the same key.
Okay, yeah. Good. Because for some reason I was remembering that in G major, but that's obviously wrong.
I don't think there is a G major suite. First one.
Okay, I knew there was one. Oh, the third is in C. The first is in G. There you go. Okay. All right. Yeah. So this is Jan Matthews, one of Masumi Rostad's students at the University of Illinois. He also, by the way, teaches violin and viola at the Community Center for the Arts in downtown Urbana, at the in the Independent Media Center building there, and has quite a lot of students if you're interested. Jan Matthews in the Barret from the fourth suite of Johann Sebastian Bach, originally for cello, and played here in viola. And one of the pieces that is going to be on the recital tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Smith Memorial Hall on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana, in the Memorial Room, which is on the second floor. on the east side of the building, if I have my directions right, 6 o'clock tomorrow night, members of Masumi Rostad's studio. And just looking at the time, I want to make sure everybody gets a chance to play. So who's next? That would be Alyssa Rago. And you're going to do which movement from which suite?
I'm playing the Allemande from the first suite.
And just really quickly, while you get set up, Jan, since I know you play both violin and viola, some basic differences between playing the two. Recognizing that the viola is larger, right?
The viola is larger. It Physically. Has a low C string like a cello instead of the high E string. Violas come in different sizes. Even grown-up people play smaller or bigger violas.
I didn't actually know that.
Yeah, so they pretty much go. You get all variants, but standard sizes are between 15.5 inches to 17 inches, and that's body length, not including the length of the neck.
And playing them, some quick technical difference. You said more patience it takes to play viola.
Yeah, that's just a personality thing, because you have to deal with violinists so much more.
Are we going to launch into violin jokes?
Oh, we shouldn't get too much.
All right, we might pick up on that later. Okay, yeah. Alyssa Rago, music from which suite did you say?
The first
suite here on Live and Local. Excuse me, Alyssa Rago playing music from the first suite of Johann Sebastian Bach. And, you know, my memory is about this long. Which movement was that?
The Allemande.
The Allemande. Okay. I should really recognize the differences between all those dances. Most I just recognize the bourrées and the jigs because they're fast. But this could be sort of fast, slow, depending upon how you play it. And this is going to be an interesting exercise. It's already an interesting exercise for me to listen. Last week, Stefan Milankovic was here, I think, on Wednesday, and violinist on faculty at the University of Illinois, in fact, giving a recital Wednesday night with Rohan da Silva, which gives me a chance to say Rohan da Silva will actually be on tomorrow's show, talking about the role of the collaborative pianist. But anyway, Stefan played some Bach live in the studio, and he made the comment that he tells his students that you can play Bach however you want. which is itself, which I didn't have time to pursue, which would really have been something to pursue. But we've had two very different approaches to the music of Bach just now, coming out of the same studio.
That could be a whole series of shows, actually.
I think you're
just go into
which
that
might
point.
Be, which might kind of be fun as yeah. long as we didn't take it too far. All right, so who's next? Luis,
I'll be playing next.
Okay.
Oh, I'll be playing the prelude from the second suite.
Prelude from the second suite. Luis Bellerin in the Masumi Rosad studio. Again, this recital is tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Smith Memorial Hall on the University of Illinois campus in Urbana. The prelude from the fourth suite, which is it? You're not even sure. I'm more sure. How about that? Second suite of Johann Sebastian Bach, played by Luis Bellerin here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. We better move right along to our last performer, Who is Jing Chen, who is going to do which movement from which suite?
This will be the minuet 1 and 2 from the first suite.
Minuets from the first suite here on Live and Local. By the way, Masumi Rostad, who is their teacher, is here, but he's in the other room because he's got himself a rather bad case of, and somewhat amusing case of laryngitis. Sorry, Masumi. That also provoked some coughing fits, so we thought we'd just leave him out of this conversation for now. Next time, for sure. Jing Chen, music of Bach on Live and Local. Great. So collective applause for everybody. Nicely done. Jing Chen, the minuet movements from the first suite. I can't remember this. First suite.
First suite, that's correct.
Of Johann Sebastian Bach. So these are just four of how many performers?
We'll have 8 performers tomorrow.
All members of the studio, all undergrads except you, or are there other graduate students?
No, I think we're pretty half and half. 4 grad students, 4 undergrads.
And I know, Jan, you're a grad student. Are the rest of you
undergrads?
Okay. Jan Matthews played first, and then Alyssa Rago. Then we heard Luis Bellerin, and finally Jing Chen here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. You all sounded great, and it's very interesting to hear the 4 quite different approaches to the music of Bach. What would be interesting would be to follow up with Masumi and find out what sort of coaching goes on to create 4 different approaches, not entirely different. But also, I will say that it strikes me as a credit to him and to you all that you're retaining your personalities in his studio, which I'm sure was going to be would be one of the answers he would give.
Hopefully,
as very important. Yeah. Well, you sound great, and I think this certainly bodes well for anybody who wants to go hear your recital tomorrow night. Tomorrow night, 6 o'clock, in the Memorial Room up on the second floor of Smith Music Hall on the University of Illinois campus. Lots of Bach, played by 8 violists in the studio of Masumi Rostad. And you heard him on Live and Local here on FM 90.9. Going to have a weather forecast just very shortly, and then news headlines at 12:01. Julie Amacher is in with classical music at 1:06. And on tomorrow's Live and Local, we'll hear from pianist Rohan de Silva in advance of his recital, with Stefan Milenkovic, a varied program Wednesday night at the Krannert Center at 7:30.